And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We're going to talk to Vanessa Beely, 21st Century Wire, in London. And we'll also, later in the show, we'll be talking to David Newberry of the Injured Workers Association. They're having a demonstration in front of Queen's Park on Friday, June the 1st. We are joined, I believe, right now by Vanessa Beely herself. Are you there, Vanessa?
I'm here. Hi, Phil.
Thank you very much, Vanessa. You must be tired. You've had a terrific weekend. I follow you on Twitter, so I know how busy you are. you hardly do anything without my making notes here. pulled off your organization and friends, managed to have a media on trial, I'm going to call it a conference, and it was a struggle to do this in a country that prides itself on its on its liberties and freedom of speech, et cetera. Tell us about the conference and before we get to the more meaty matters of events in Syria.
Basically, Media on Trial was the brainchild of Sheila Coombs of Froom Stop War, an anti-war group based in Froom, so the southwest of England. Mm-hmm. This was our third event. We'd done one in the hometown of Froom, which I think attracted over 400 audience. We then did another event in London, which had an audience of well over 500, mm-hmm. including a number of mainstream media journalists. Mm-hmm. Those two events came under a degree of attack. The London event was, they basically members of, we believe, the Syria Solidarity UK organization who support the so-called revolution in Syria. Came to the venue where the event was going to be held a few hours before we started and poured what we believe was sort of skunk water all over the carpet at the front of the church. Mm-hmm. So they ensured that the building stunk basically when people came in. Mm-hmm. And then they staged a protest. But it still went ahead then and was extremely successful. And then we'd planned the third event in Leeds, and we booked at the Leeds City Museum well in advance. And a few weeks before the event was due to go ahead, we believe again that the Leeds City Museum came under pressure from, among others, a parliamentary advisor, an advisor to the House of Commons, Toby Dickinson, and a number of mainstream media outlets. And so basically the museum, under a number of sort of spurious excuses, cancelled on us. Mm-hmm. We then managed to get a second venue who cancelled again, we believe. It sounds very much as if, again, undue pressure was put upon them. So they cancelled on Wednesday, so about 5 days before uh-huh. the event was due to happen. Mm-hmm. So through a number of contacts of mine, we managed to actually contact an Islamic center in Leeds. God bless them. And they agreed, the Bab ul-Ilm Center, which is the Gateway to Knowledge Center, very appropriate. And they agreed to hold the event in a marquee in the grounds of their center. Uh-huh. So we had to keep the address and location of the venue secret until the last minute because of the risk, obviously, of protests and attempts to shut it down. Mm-hmm. And we still had an audience of, I think, over 200 in the end that came despite all the complications because, of course, we couldn't let people know where it was until the
Amazing.
Saturday evening.
We're talking about the United Kingdom. But, of course, we just had a wedding where I heard one of the questions from the audience, and the gentleman wanted to know why the prince was wearing a military uniform. I thought, that is a good point.
That was actually Ambassador Peter Ford who mentioned that, the ex-British ambassador to Syria, of course.
Yes.
And he actually brought up that point, and he said, you know, it's a very clear demonstration of the fact that Britain is a military nation. You know, global Britain, I mean, as Theresa May likes to call it, is reaching for its imperialistic status again.
I want to ask, Vanessa, it's very striking to me. There's an echo here of the career of life, Bertrand Russell. He had a great quote. He said, in Britain, we have our freedom of speech until we need it. And here you are. Britain isn't at war with anybody. At least it doesn't say it is. And you want to hold a conference about the danger of involvement in a war that is going on, with Syria is defending itself against a lot of parties. And yet you have to go to all these pains in order to have a meeting?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I mean, I made the comment in my presentation that those who are advocating for peace and for political and diplomatic resolution are the ones who are being demonized, marginalized, silenced. They obviously clearly tried to shut us down and prevent us from speaking. And there has been a concerted smear campaign running probably for about 6 months now against all of us, a little bit longer for myself and Eva, Eva Bartlett. And,
a
you know,
Canadian,
it's quite
we
extraordinary.
Know. I'm sorry, I just wanted to mention Eva is from Ontario. We're very proud of her work, actually.
Yes, she's amazing.
I'm sorry I interrupted you at that point.
No, and I mean, I think what's extraordinary is those who are given a platform, given the awards, given the ability to express themselves, of course, are those who are calling for war and who are producing the propaganda that is designed to take us to war. You know, it's an incredible inversion of what reality should be. And of course, you know, we've known this for a very long time, and we have the precedents of Iraq and Libya and going much further than that, back to Vietnam, etc. But, you know, it's extraordinary, I think, the level to which the sensationalism and hysteria has risen over Syria against those who stand in the way, let's say, of the objectives of our combined governments, who are, of course, intent still on regime change and the destabilization of a sovereign nation.
Yeah. I was also struck by the fact that if we were to back up a couple of 3 years, President Obama, whom everybody thinks of as a very nice person and liberal and all that, he tried to mount an offensive against the Syrian government itself. He was talking about a direct assault on Damascus. And the British Parliament, to everybody's surprise and pleasure, said that they didn't agree with that. And then they went into a different mode. About maybe 6 months later, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but they began to say, no, we're really, what we're concerned about are terrorists, so we think we ought to go in there to help with the terrorists. Is that how we got here? I mean, could you correct me on that?
No, that's correct. I think the vote to not get involved in Syria was in 2013 after the alleged Ghouta chemical weapon attacks in August, I believe. And there was a vote after that which failed, basically. It was defeated. The movement was defeated. I think it was, I can never catch up on dates. I think it was 2016 that it was then the vote swung the other way, basically. But the UK, I mean, we know now that the UK has boots on the ground, particularly in the northeast. So does France. I mean, if we remember back to 2016, France bombed Manbij, an area in the north of Syria, killing over 100 civilians, along with the US. Very recently, of course, the US has bombed Syrian army positions, I believe, in Deir ez-Zor. And yesterday, in fact, Russian military advisors and soldiers were killed, again, close to Deir ez-Zor. By, of course, the U.S. proxies, whether those are SDF or ISIS. It's becoming, you know, those lines are becoming very blurred now. There was a statement, I believe, by Lavrov today that there are a number of ex-ISIS fighters in the refugee camps around the U.S.-occupied camp of Al-Tanf, close to the Jordan border. So, You know, it's a very complex situation, and it's sometimes quite hard to figure out exactly which nation is doing what. But I think it's very clear that the UK has been, if not overtly involved in this campaign, certainly from an intelligence perspective, my impression is that the UK is the driver of much of the intelligence operations in to destabilize Syria and to bring about regime change. And we mustn't forget that in 2004, BBC Media Action, Juliet Harkin was talking about embedding media activists. So as far back as 2004, embedding media activists to, quote, bring about change and to influence those within the government who were possible, in inverted commas, reformers and were able to form an opposition to the authoritarian government.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Vanessa Bealey, 21st Century Wire, and Vanessa's also on Twitter. And this media on trial, part of the point was to say that the media is really conniving with, in a criminal way, practically, to create circumstances which will do lead to violence and also to distorting the facts of the violence when it occurs. I noticed you quoted a lawyer, Toronto lawyer, Chris Black, and it was a very nice quote, to the effect that, you know, that's a crime to provide false information in order to justify violence against civilians.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, I'd been having a few conversations actually with Christopher in the last few weeks leading up to the media on trial event. Because actually one of the questions we had raised in advance, which I think had caused such consternation among certain mainstream media journalists in the UK, apart from obviously the White Helmet work, was the fact that by embedding themselves with the terrorist groups, by platforming these terrorist groups, I mean, and I'm talking internationally recognized terrorist groups,
yes.
I'm not using that term, without qualification. I'm talking groups like ISIS, like Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda, and splinter groups from Nusra Front, which have been rebranded, but who are still considered as a terrorist group. Mm-hmm. And there are specific media outlets and journalists, CNN, for example, The Guardian, Channel 4, who have clearly embedded themselves with those terrorist groups and lionized their activities and whitewashed the atrocities they have committed. So to some degree, the fact that they are platforming terrorist groups and, if you like, amplifying their propaganda and their ideological propaganda is in violation of some subsections of our own UK Anti-Terrorism Act. So mm-hmm. I'd been discussing that with Christopher.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we'd got onto the subject of how the Soviet Union in the 50s had tried to introduce a resolution to the UN General Assembly that war propaganda be criminalized, basically, that it be seen as ideological aggression. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was rejected by the West, despite despite it being in clear alignment with the UN Charter.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Chris's quote, or the one that I used, was in relation to the use of the free speech umbrella by the West to defend their right to use war propaganda, which is a crime against humanity in the sense dehumanize entire peoples and to incite hatred and racism.
Mm-hmm. A footnote to that, I believe that you produced on your Twitter. I've seen it on Twitter. The former editor of Time magazine, was it, who actually came out for war propaganda?
Yes, I think that was something I retweeted, probably on my travels on the way home. So I've
it's probably by the way, yes, just for I'm losing track of your movement. When were you in Syria last?
I was in Syria about a month ago. Then I've been back and I've done a couple of talking events and trying to catch up with the articles.
Mm-hmm.
And then I left for the UK on Friday. We had the event on Sunday and then I basically flew back today.
Yeah. By the way, this is all available at 21st Century Wire. People could just go, and the speeches and the questions, et cetera, is all available there.
Well, actually, the live stream of the event went out on ukcolumn.org, and we will obviously be posting. I don't know whether we'll split it into individual presentations, because I think the whole event went on for about 4 hours with the questions and all the talks. But I think it was an incredibly successful event. I mean, what was really nice was that people from the center who had no idea who we were, but who had basically defended free speech, and you know, all kudos to them for actually having the courage to do that, because I fully explained the situation when I asked them permission to use their center for our event. But the audience as well. I mean, I think what we're finding, Phil, is that people are appreciating that they can come to an area where they can also express their views, you know, without feeling that they don't have that right, or feeling that they're going to be ridiculed, or feeling that they shouldn't say one thing or another. You know, they can express themselves freely, and they can discuss those ideas both during the Q&A, but also afterwards with the speakers. And I think it's very important now. I think that there is such a chasm between the mainstream media and the street, you know, as Goebbels would describe it, that propaganda needs the street in order to be successful. Well, the media now has disconnected itself to such an extent from the street. And I think making ourselves publicly available like this is incredibly important now.
Oh, absolutely. Again, it's Vanessa Bealey, 21st Century Wire. Please go to that site, by the way, and listen to the talks. I enjoyed it very much. I want to make sure I ask you about this document. A week ago, I thought you had you produced at your site, and then it's gone off and around, and I'm really glad it. A document produced, it's a British government document, which basically talks about, explains in a nice bureaucratic way of why, of how much money they're giving toward the White Helmet Organization and others, and the benefits that they get. I thought that was sort of like a case closed. If I was a lawyer, I'd say, Your Honor, here's the evidence. All you need to do is read this, because we're saying that they engage in support for an organization that's embedded with terrorists and all, and they seem proud of it. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think part of my presentation, again, was talking about this this idea of criminalizing war propaganda, and then coming down to international law and the fact that a General Assembly Resolution 2131 declares that no state shall organize, assist, foment, finance, incite, or tolerate subversive, terrorist, or armed activities directed towards the violent overthrow of the regime of another state. And very, very clearly, what I demonstrate was, with this document, for example, and with the fact that the British government had set up an organization called IncoStrat to produce public relations material for a number of the armed opposition groups. So while the British government is claiming that it's providing non-lethal aid by changing public perception regarding a number of these armed groups, and one of them, of course, is Jaish al-Islam, one of the most sectarian and brutal groups that was most prevalent in Douma, that ran the repentance prisons, and in fact another prison was discovered in the last 24 hours, I believe, underground. So it was one of the most incredibly brutal and well-armed groups, Saudi-financed, and its PR, its public image, was being polished by a UK PR company, IncoStrat. And then, you know, we dovetail into the 200,000 that was given to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights in 2012 by the British government. That's very recently been revealed as well. And then we come to this document. Now, for me, the extraordinary thing, not only the funding of the White Helmets, which we, you know, we've known for some time, but it's the wording of this document, which is quite extraordinary. Not only do they admit that Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, who are known to be a sort of
an intervention construct in collusion with NED and USAID that have been used to give the humanitarian context to manufacture consent for a number of imperialist interventions.
Mm-hmm.
But the wording that, as the document goes on, it basically says throughout the bombardment by Russia since September 2015, the White Helmets have provided essential corroboration that strikes were not targeting Daesh, but moderate opposition entities. Now let's read this again. Essential corroboration.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that an extraordinary phrase,
yes,
Phil?
Yes.
I mean, this sounds exactly as if the White Helmets are tasked with providing the evidence that corroborates the UK government official narrative on Syria and enables their criminalization of the Syrian government.
It's good information, right? And we paid a lot of money for it.
Exactly. And it even goes on. It says they've also provided confidence to statements made by the... So, I mean, this is clearly, actually, an admission, if we look at the lexicon they use, that the White Helmets are effectively providing the evidence that corroborates the UK government policy in Syria. Whereas, in fact, surely that's the evidence from on the ground that should determine the policy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's this complete reality inversion by my government and obviously the US through USAID, and Chemonix is also funding this organization. And we've had Heather Nowak recently saying, you know, congratulating the White Helmets on the excellent job they've done for the US government. So, you know, I don't think we've ever seen such an above ground partnership between what is effectively an intelligence asset on the ground inside and a nation that is being targeted for destabilization and the administrations that are managing that asset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of the quotes from it, we continue to provide stipends, training, and equipment, and supporting them to strengthen their relationships with governance actors. I love that one. That's a strangulated term if I ever saw one. Because there are other governance actors that have been getting money also from the British government, aren't there?
Yes, there are. I mean, I've again reported on this extensively. There are a number of projects, let's say, shadow state construct projects that have been run by the UK government. One of those is the local councils, which work actually in collusion with one another, in collaboration with one another and with the terrorist groups.
And they have a common goal, which is regime change.
Absolutely.
So the British are paying for a regime change exercise in Syria,
which violates international law, and the British government is a signatory to international law. So my government is in violation of international law. It's acting criminally inside Syria, as is the entire US coalition, of course, and the Gulf states and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's becoming clearer and clearer that from, and again, speaking, you know, the wonderful thing with Christopher is Christopher Black, he has such a wealth of experience and knowledge, and he can very clearly put it into I'm not a lawyer, so what he is so excellent at is putting it into a sort of an understandable diagram almost. You know, he can explain exactly what they're violating and how they're violating in it, and I think that's very important for people to understand.
Mm-hmm. I really hope they'll go to 21st Century Wire and find this also on your Twitter account. It's right at the top, and it's where it should remain, I hope, everybody. Because it's the old matter of it's out of their own mouths where they detail in a kind of and mentioning little things like, and they must be a good group. They got nominated for the Nobel Prize. Yeah, by whom? I mean, you know,
well, yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean,
this is really
the
like
the
puppet
the
master
is
talking
running,
about his puppets.
Know. Yeah.
It's Vanessa Beely we're talking to and 21st Century Wire. There's a developing story that I want to get your thoughts on. The U.S. today and Britain, I guess, and others look like they're going to make some kind of a problem. They're threatening anyway. the way they title it in the Toronto Star is to say U.S. rebukes Assad's attack threats. And now the army of Syria is defeating the terrorists, and there's a place called Dara, I understand, somewhere near the Golan Heights. And the U.S. says that the Syrian army can't go there. Why?
Well, I mean, the thing is that Dara, of course, is right on the demarcation line between Syrian territory and the Israeli illegally occupied territory of Golan. I also believe that there are, very much as there were in Ghouta and in East Aleppo, there are U.S. forces among the armed groups in Dara. I mean, I know over the last year I've heard information from very reliable sources of the presence of U.S. troops in that area. And of course, it's a pivotal, it would be a pivotal battle again, because it would basically mean then that the Syrian army is right on the border with Golan. And so that's a direct threat for Israel. And so, of course, the U.S. and the U.K. are going to step in.
And they're running out of assets, right? I mean, they're being squeezed out, the terrorists.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, you know, Damascus now on the 21st of May was entirely liberated from terrorist groups, so the south and the east, you know, which is an extraordinary, extraordinary feat for the Syrian Arab army and its allies to have achieved.
Yes. I mean, hallelujah. Quite extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for the Syrian people in Damascus, it's a huge, huge event. I mean, it means the end of mortars. It means the end of the daily deaths and mutilations by mortar fire from those embedded terrorist groups. In the south, of course, it was ISIS. But there are, you know, there is still Idlib, and we're already seeing the ramping up of the hysteria by the media. We can see it bubbling, you know, ready to be released about Idlib. And Dara is definitely the next target for the Syrian Arab army, as I said, because that basically then gives them control over the whole area south of Damascus and puts them directly in line with Israel in the occupied Golan, won't say Golan Heights.
Which, of course, is not
only the Golan Heights, it's the whole Golan territory.
Yeah, nothing extraordinary in that. And that before the terrorists began, that was the situation, and there was actually no serious activity going on in that area of any threat to anybody prior to the terrorists.
No, exactly. And we know also that the terrorists, you know, we know that Israel has been treating the terrorists in its hospitals. We know that there have been reports that they are even recruiting and training ISIS recruits right on its border, obviously, as a deterrent against what they perceive to be the threat of the Iranian forces and Hezbollah, of course. And so, you know, I think we're just going to see now the next stage of the battle. And I think we need to brace ourselves for the next round of media hysteria, the potential of further staged chemical weapon attacks. You know, and I think those are absolutely inevitable.
Yeah. Well, that's why you held the conference media on trial. Congratulations on that, on the success of it. And thank you very, very much, Vanessa, for giving us this time.
Thank you so much for having me on, Phil.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. We'll hear a little Phil Oakes, and we'll come back and talk to David Newberry.